Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for listening for that moment of silence we just took. We took a moment of silence for the callers of for the people who just paid, who lost their lives today in the battle. I thought I was talking at the time, but I see my mic was off, everybody. I was watching some news clippings of what transpired today. And, yeah, that's what's happening. I'm having a hard time getting my studio up also, everybody. And that's why the show is running late like it is. So what I'm going to do is now I'm up now. Let's start the show off right now, everybody. You ready, Ebony? All right, all right. You ready, Jamil? All right, all right. Okay, America, you ready? Well, let's go on there and get the Jimmy Lee Underground radio show started right now. We're going to bring in Marvin Gaye, and then we're going on some news clippings. And then we're on air, everybody. All our prayers and thoughts go out to the family members of those who are injured and lost their lives also. Thank you, people.
Marvin didn't try to be magic or charismatic and all that. He just was. Even when he sung the national anthem, I mean, it was Marvin Gaye. You know, it was just unique. It was special.
Can you see?
The man you're about to see and hear, should you be so foolish as to have just joined us, is Ray Charles.
Hello. All right. Three, four.
I got something, y'all, in my bones. Make me want to shout hallelujah. And I want to
sing along.
Every voice and sing, till it in heaven ring with the harmony. Oh, let it be. Let us rejoice and rise high. let us march on till victory won. God of our weary years, God of our solitaires, thou who has brought us this far,
apologize for a little delay in time there. I decided to take some time out for those who lost their lives. Today is 4:15. Tax day, everybody. It's tax day. You know, and there was an attack on America. Now, some say it was domestic. Some say it's foreign. It's difficult to say, but let's not make a judgment until all the answers are in. They say that a lot of tragedy happens around this time period of the month of April. They point to Waco, Columbine, Oklahoma City. They say they all took place around this time period. Some folks say it coincided with Hitler's birthday. Who knows? What's to say? But I find it very interesting that on Patriots Day in Boston and Tax Day in America that something would transpire. Now, the White House, I think, are making great plans to check all resources, check every tree down to see what's going on and what is happening. You know. So let's find out what's happening. Let's go to let's go to the witnesses. This is Al Jazeera, everybody. This is Al Jazeera, how Al Jazeera sees shows what's going on to the world.
Josh, I understand you're what, 6 miles away from the scene of the explosions, at the Boston Marathon. I see a lot of ambulances there behind you. Just give us a sense of what's happening around you.
We're going to take our car?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm about 6 blocks away from Copley Square. We're on Columbus here, and the ambulances go for as far as we can see. There are dozens and dozens of ambulances with their lights on, all in line. There are scores of runners still roaming about. In fact, while standing here and getting ready for this shot, a runner walked by with her family. Her father was at the finish line. His name is John Cowan. John, can you come over here a second? John's an orthopedic surgeon up from Florida to watch his daughter run in the race. He was at the finish line when the bombs went off. Can you describe the scene there, please?
We heard the first bomb go off, and maybe a minute or two afterwards, the second bomb went off. We were right across the street from it. Really lucky because the crowd was much heavier on my side of the street than it was on the opposite side. People started running one way when the first bomb went off. They started running the other way when the second bomb went off. And, I mean, it was obvious what it was. So I went across the street and tried to help.
You ran to the scene because you're a surgeon.
Yeah.
What was that scene like when you got there?
It looked like an IED from Afghanistan. I mean, there was one guy lying there with his leg blown off at his thigh. There's another one with a foot blown off. There was the worst one was a little boy whose mother was holding on to him, but he was obviously expired. We had another woman who arrested while we were there. And there were a bunch of open fractures, you know, it was a mess. There was one man who had his foot partially blown off, and he had a three-year-old that was sitting in a stroller, and I picked up the three-year-old. This three-year-old had a laceration on his head, but he's absolutely petrified. So I took him, tried to calm him down, but there were so many other people needed help. I passed him off to one of the policemen, and they took him. And of course, the father's concern was, you know, where's my son? Mm-hmm. You know, is he okay?
Mm-hmm.
So.
And now that the father was separated from the son.
Oh yeah, I wanted to get him out of there. You know, you didn't know what was going to happen next.
I'm sure family members are separated across the city tonight.
I was separated from my family. You know, we just finally got together.
I noticed you haven't even been home to clean up. You have blood down your side and blood all over your jeans.
Yeah.
Has it really set in what you saw today?
You know, it's beyond me how people can do that to other people. You know, I mean, these people just came out to have a good day, mm-hmm. you know, and they were enjoying it and having a good time. And then for that to happen, you know, it's horrible.
Thank you, John.
Okay.
Thank you, John. That's what the scene's like here for now. We'll keep reporting live from the scene. Back to you, Doha.
Josh, thank you very much. But do stay with us for a few minutes, Josh, because I do want you to tell us more about the scene there. You said lots of ambulances behind you, but obviously not a lot of people on the streets right now.
Indeed, that's true. There are ambulances that go for blocks and blocks. I walked down about four blocks, and they were all the way down there. So there's dozens of ambulances, all with their lights on. However, the doctor we were just speaking to said that they had all the bodies cleared and injuries cleared while he was still there. So it's unclear to me what the ambulances are here for. You have a number of first responders that are kind of roaming about the street, as well as runners, families, and the locals who live here.
And you came from the airport, obviously, from Logan International Airport. What is the mood like? The atmosphere like in Boston after this?
Well, we've seen a number of runners who are walking around with these kind of aluminum foil-looking thermal blankets. The temperature has dropped. It's around 15 degrees Celsius at this point and getting colder. We've seen a number of people walking around with just a shocked look on their face, kind of wide-eyed. They look at you and just kind of walk past. And everyone that we've stopped has shared their story with us. A number of them have been there at the finish line. Others are still separated from their family. Another one, their hotel is next to where the explosion went off. They were from Richmond, Virginia, so they're looking for another hotel room to stay tonight. I think everyone at this point is just trying to put the immediate pieces back together and figure out how they're going to move forward.
And what is the security like, Josh, if you can see any on the streets? I mean, is there a heightened level of security in Boston right now?
Where we are, there's not a heightened level of security. However, about six blocks down, there are police barricades and just too many police vehicles to count. There are constantly helicopters overhead, both police and life flight helicopters. But mostly where we are, it's first responders, EMTs, medical techs, and ambulance drivers that are waiting to go to the scene.
Okay, Josh, thank you very much for the moment. That's Algiers' Josh Rushing reporting there live from downtown Boston in the way.
Thank you, Governor. At 2:50 p.m. today, there were simultaneous explosions that occurred along the route of the Boston Marathon near the finish line. These explosions occurred 50 to 100 yards apart, and each scene resulted in multiple casualties. At this point in time, all of the victims have been removed from the scene. We have sent officers to hospitals to be in touch with family members and possible witnesses. We immediately activated a system of response that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and the federal government has in place for these type of incidents. My first two calls were to the special agent in charge of the FBI and to the colonel of the state police. both Rick DeLaurier and Tim Albans immediately sent resources. We have, at this point in time, determined that there has been a third incident that has occurred. There was an explosion that occurred at the JFK library. So this is very much an ongoing event at this point in time. We are not certain that these incidents are related, but we are treating them as if they are. We're recommending to people that they stay home, that if they're in hotels in the area, that they return to their rooms, and that they don't go anyplace and congregate in large crowds.
And security team on the events in Boston. We're continuing to monitor and respond to the situation as it unfolds, and I've directed the full resources of the federal government to help state and local authorities protect our people, increase security around the United States as necessary, and investigate what happened. The American people will say a prayer for Boston tonight, and Michelle and I send our deepest thoughts and prayers to the families of the victims in the wake of this senseless loss. We don't yet have all the answers, but we do know that multiple people have been wounded, some gravely, in explosions at the Boston Marathon. I've spoken to FBI Director Mueller and Secretary of Homeland Security Napolitano, and they're mobilizing the appropriate resources to investigate and to respond. I've updated leaders of Congress in both parties, and we reaffirm that on days like this there are no Republicans or Democrats. We are Americans united in concern for our fellow citizens. I've also spoken with Governor Patrick and Mayor Menino and made it clear that they have every single federal resource necessary to care for the victims and counsel the families. And above all, I made clear to them that all Americans stand with the people of Boston. Boston police, firefighters, and first responders, as well as the National Guard, responded heroically and continue to do so as we speak. It's a reminder that so many Americans serve and sacrifice on our behalf every single day, without regard to their own safety, in dangerous and difficult circumstances. And we salute all those who assisted in responding so quickly and professionally to this tragedy. We still do not know who did this or why, and people shouldn't jump to conclusions before we have all the facts. But make no mistake, we will get to the bottom of this, and we will find out who did this. We'll find out why they did this. Any responsible individuals, any responsible groups will feel the full weight of justice. Today is a holiday in Massachusetts, Patriots Day. It's a day that celebrates the free and fiercely independent spirit that this great American city of Boston has reflected from the earliest days of our nation. And it's a day that draws the world to Boston's streets in a spirit of friendly competition. Boston is a tough and resilient town, so are its people. I'm supremely confident that Bostonians will pull together, take care of each other, and move forward as one proud city, and as they do, the American people will be with them every single step of the way. You should anticipate that as we get more information, our teams will provide you briefings. We're still in the investigation stage at this point, but I just want to reiterate, we will find out who did this, and we will hold them accountable. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that was the President of the United States of America. And like he said, right now, we all Americans, not Democrats, not Republicans, we all Americans today. Because I think they feel like I feel, this was not a foreign attack. I feel that after I could be wrong, everybody, but I feel that after we shake through all the information, this 415 was a staged attack because it took place on the 100th. People fail to realize the 100th today is the 100th anniversary of the institution of the tax on America. And then you got what happened in Boston. Who knows? Boston had the Tea Party because they was mad that England was taxing them so much. They want to start a revolution. Could this be the sign of the revolution? Who knows? Matter of fact, this is the history, 100-year history of the taxation on America. Let's see. Let me give you all a brief history on why we pay taxes.
I mean, y'all should see if we do should pay taxes or if it's a good thing to have taxes and I might not go to represent us. I mean, you throw that out there. You figure that out. But let me give you a little brief history on the taxation of Americans.
While we invest part of our savings to help finance the world's most efficient business system, at the same time we pay taxes to government to finance many kinds of services which also contribute to our way of life. For example, our taxes must provide the necessary funds to improve and expand our school system. Our taxes must be sufficient to pay for city streets, health, fire, and police protection, and of course, aid to the needy. Our state taxes help pay for highways, educational institutions, and among other things, help to finance important experiments to increase the productivity of our farms. Our federal taxes pay for irrigation and reclamation projects, for national parks, postal services, the Weather Bureau, and many other services. Our taxes have to pay for the enormous cost of past wars and provide the funds for a defense program which will ensure the safety of our country. In addition, all of us should be willing to pay whatever taxes are necessary to enable efficient government to improve or expand any essential service. But with our present tax load, we should avoid pressuring government for any new services that aren't absolutely necessary. Because we all know the more our government provides, the more taxes it's forced to collect. None of us can escape. Big business. Small business. Farmers. Workers. Housewives and all of us have to pay our share. Demanding more and more from government could create a tax burden heavy enough to crack essential blocks in the foundation of our business system. Therefore, we shouldn't let our taxes reach a point where they destroy our ability to save and invest. For, as we have seen, our rising standard of living depends upon a constant flow of savings dollars into our business system each year.
So, yes, ladies and gentlemen, a little brief history on the taxation in America. And like the little PSA said, we should not let our taxes hit us so hard we're not able to support ourselves or save or buy gas or buy bread. We should have a modern-day tax code where it's efficient, one flat tax. But that's just my opinion. And again, I hope that after the smoke clears, we'll find out who's behind this dastardly deed that took place today in Boston. Because what we have now, we're going to have the next April, all of April, going into May, to figure out a retaliation strategy if it's a foreign country. But let's say it's an American national. Then what's going to happen? Are the gun laws going to come in? Is there going to be a gun national registry? Will there be more cameras on the street? Will your privacy, will your personal privacy be violated? Compromised. Good correction. Compromised. We're going to answer that and much more questions on the other side. Be back in a minute.
Partners in Community Building focuses on credit building, financial literacy, and home ownership for residents throughout Chicago and Illinois. All of our services are free. Call 312-328-0873 to get additional information on our homeownership counseling, rental assistance, Cook County foreclosure mediation, and small accessible repairs for seniors programs. PCIB is a HUD-certified nonprofit counseling agency committed to addressing the housing needs of all people. Call 312-328-0873 to schedule an appointment or visit us at www.pcibchicago.org.
For true inspiration, check out singer, songwriter, and radio personality Sylvia Fedrick. Sylvia, your sister under God's construction, brings to you her best in Christian contemporary gospel tunes, and they are available for download at www.sangsyl.com. That's SANGSYL.com. Or you can visit her profile at Chicago Black Business Network. For bookings, call Sassy Michelle at 512-914-4221.
Want to learn the secrets of the wealthy? Do you think that the wealthy sell their gold and silver, or do they buy gold and silver? Learn to create wealth, collect wealth, and preserve wealth for you and future generations. Find out how you can acquire free silver every month. Visit goldandsilverplan.com. That's goldandsilverplan.com. What you don't know can keep you struggling financially. What you know can change your life. Be in the know. Visit goldandsilverplan.com today.
Hey, you want more money in your pocket, right? Savers are losers, unless you save like the rich and beat inflation. The secret? Save the right kind of money. Pure, solid, 24-karat gold or silver for as little as $20 a week, direct from the mint. Don't spend money. Exchange bad money for good money. Start today at SaveMetalMoney.com. That's SaveMetalMoney.com. The chains of slavery in the modern world are not forged with links of iron, but with the bonds of limiting ideas and debt.
Be in business for yourself, but not by yourself. Team up with a company voted the 57th most promising by Forbes. With no money to collect from your customers, no credit checks, and no cost for you to join. Visit electricmoneyteam.com, 773-980-9288. That's electricmoneyteam.com, 773-980-9288.
Hi there, I'm the X-Man, Xavier Paul. I'm a national network voiceover talent. You've heard my voice represent hundreds of brands and businesses for the past 15 years. Well, now it's your turn. I understand how important it is to promote your business or event in the right way. That starts with quality radio spot production and the nation's top voiceover talent. You might wonder, how do I get started? What's the best approach? What voice talent do I use? And most importantly, can I do it affordably? That's why I created CoolVoiceRadio.com. I take you to the finish line, giving you everything you need to advertise effectively on the radio. I'll help you create your concept, write your spot, even choose your music and cast your voice talent and get it aired on the radio. Now that's cool. Email me today at info@coolvoiceradio.com or call 646-326-7800 because nothing beats the right sound.
347-838-9825. Today is old blues sensations Bessie Smith's birthday today. And so let's go ahead and just do a little mini bio. Happy birthday, Bessie. And you too, Harold. We're going to do a little special dedication to Harold in a minute. But happy birthday, Bessie. Matter of fact, we should play the birthday song, but I'll play it after the bio. Bessie Smith, mini bio, everybody.
My man's got a heart like a rocket.
Bessie Smith is the greatest female blues singer who's ever lived.
Born in Chattanooga, Tennessee, in 1894, Bessie Smith hit the theater circuit at the age of 18, touring in minstrel shows and cabarets. She started her career as a dancer on the same bill with legendary singer Ma Rainey.
Ma Rainey was always known as the ugliest woman in show business, and Bessie was not. Bessie was known as being beautiful.
Bessie segued from dancing to singing, and her talents drew large audiences. So she created her own show.
Bessie Smith's shows were often extravagant. She had as many as 40 people in the cast.
Bessie's show traveled the country, and in many areas of America, segregation was the norm.
In some places, there were black rooming houses, theatrical rooming houses, where they stayed. So when Bessie Smith had her own railroad car, that became their home away from home, and they cooked there and they slept there.
Bessie's success was enormous for the time, and she was pulling in the unheard-of sum of $2,000 a week.
Just the whole idea that Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey were able to make a living at that time. These women were writing their stories, singing them, and making their own money, and they were emancipated women to me. They were the first feminists.
Bessie understood the hard-drinking, promiscuous, and violent life she sang about in the blues because she lived it.
At the end of the songs, you always got this sense that, despite all this, that this was a woman who was going to overcome it, and she did.
By the early 1920s, Columbia Records discovered her, and she became the best-selling blues artist of her time, making almost 160 recordings, including tunes like Backwater Blues and Tain't Nobody's Business If I Do.
She had a good business mind. She would sell the records in the aisle. She also sold other merchandise. The Bessie Smith Show was a traveling marketplace.
When I discovered Bessie Smith, I was like, oh, that's where Janis got her stuff. That's where Mick Jagger, Robert Plant, everybody's been listening to Bessie Smith.
I hate to see that evening sun go down.
Smith's rich life was cut short by a car crash at the age of 43. Thousands turned out to mourn her, but she lay in an anonymous plot until rock legend and fan Janis Joplin bought her a headstone several decades later.
She had a swagger. She had a incredible, booming voice.
Rock and roll is rhythm and blues, and it came from the blues of Bessie Smith.
Man, that was beautiful. I'm going to try to get some Bessie Smith blues for you all tomorrow. Matter of fact, let me see if I can find some more Bessie for you. Nice little sister, Bessie Smith. It's funny, when she passed away, a lot of Prince Hall Masons gave us funeral, which was kind of beautiful. I happened to see that a couple of months ago. Let me get Wild Women Don't Have the Blues. This is Bessie Smith, everybody, again.
I hear these women raving about their monkey men, about their fighting husbands and their no good friends. These poor women sit around all day and moan, wondering why their wandering papas don't come home. But why women don't worry, why women don't have the blues. Now, when you got a man, don't ever be on the square, because if you do, you have a woman everywhere. I never was known to treat no one man right. I keep on working hard both day and night, because why women don't worry, why women don't have no.
They went by names like the Empress, the Texas Nightingale, and the Georgia Peach. In the space of one decade, they rose to unprecedented heights of fame, left a legacy that inspired generations of performers, and gave America its most enduring original soul, the blues.
You get up in the morning and go to your job, and when you get there, your boss tell you, say, we're going to have a layoff because the work is getting slow, and after today or after this week, I won't be able to use you. You know, you got the blues. Either you go home unexpected and some other woman's nightgown in your bedroom, you know them been there. That's the blues. Believe it or not, even the president has the blues. And everything is really all right. Looking for work, men took their blues with them, spreading them through the countryside. But in 1902, Ma Rainey took the blues in a different direction. She put them up on stage, introduced them to the traditions of theatrical entertainment, and opened up a whole new future for the blues.
So now I bring to you the sensation of the age, the fabulous Ma Rainey, and the curtain opened up, and that was a big phonograph record, a big phonograph machine made out of plastic or wood, a folding contraption. And she opened this door, and they opened up the door, and that was Ma Rainey, like she was stepping out of a cathedral or something. And she come out singing, "Maybe a man would come to see me sometime," or something. One of them blues, them good blues. And she stepped down, and there she was, brought to you right out of the thick hole.
I worry all night. Every time my man comes home, he walks the fuss and fight. When I pick up the paper to read the news, just when I'm satisfied, yonder comes the blues.
Ma Rainey created a new performing art, vaudeville blues. She mixed blues with popular show songs, she cut them with humor, and she gave them a new theme.
Just like the rainbow, I am faded away. My daddy leaves me most every day, but he don't mean me no good. Why? Because I only wish.
Our show business meant a traveling tent and a kerosene lamp, a ragtag assortment of minstrel shows, medicine shows, and carnivals, crisscrossing the South in and out of small towns from Florida to Texas and back again. In some places, performers set up stages in a vacant lot and stayed a week, but in most, they'd come one day and be gone the next.
Yeah, that didn't have enough on when I set it up, I, you know, it had a lot on Bessie Smith, but towards the end it did. Ma Rainey was the queen of the blues by assisting a lot of blues performers in today's showmanship. It's funny how music would not be music today, rock and roll, hip-hop, jazz, country, if it wasn't for people like Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith. So Bessie Smith and the great Harold Washington, happy birthday today. And we're going to be celebrating Harold Washington's birthday with a tribute to the life and legacy of Harold Washington here in Chicago. Again, happy birthday, Harold.
Oh, today is your birthday, and I wish you many, many, many more. Oh, today is a special day, one you never had before. I'll send you flowers by the hour, candy and perfume. I'm gonna shower you, precious baby, birthday baby, tonight. Oh, today is your birthday. I wish you many, many, many more. Oh, today is a special day, one you never had before. Send you flowers by the hour with candy and perfume. I'm gonna shower you, pretty baby, birthday baby, tonight.
Washington, and when we come back, we're going to do a tribute to Harold Washington, Chicago's greatest mayor. Matter of fact, America's greatest mayor.
Wouldn't you just like to feel clean again? In Chicago and surrounding areas, Unique Towel Cleaning Service is the best cleaning service. We do basic cleaning and super cleaning, offices and apartment buildings. We will even clean your barber shop, your beauty shop, your spa or restaurant's towels and aprons. Call Unique Towel Cleaning Service at 773-484-5027. Ask us about our very special offer for our new clients. Call us at 773-484-5027 today and feel clean again.
Hello, this is Prentice L. Allison, founder and president of SPSI, Service Perfect Solutions Incorporated, a network of financial service professionals teaching people how to use life insurance and annuities to retain more of their income and pay the least tax on it. Our toll-free number is 877-902-9048. We are proud to have serviced more than 500 clients, national and international, from ages 0 to 99 for the past 30 years. My tip to you today is, if you are a business owner with at least one employee, including yourself, it would behoove you to get business life insurance. Why? Thank you for asking. 7 points I want to leave with you. Your premiums are tax deductible. Your policy bills cash tax deferred. Your cash reserve inside the policy is yours to use tax free. The policy will replace your income if death occurred prematurely. The company will pay the premiums if you become disabled. The policy will return all premiums to you when you retire. Last but not least, make sure your agent is well experienced in business life insurance. Stay tuned for more tips on how to use life insurance and annuities to help yourself today and protect your family and business tomorrow. This is Prentice L. Allison, president of SPSI. Toll-free number is 877-902-9048. I wish you well, and to God be the glory.
Does your insurance company work for you? Hi, this is Ken Robinson, President and CEO of Ken Robinson & Associates Limited. We are an insurance brokerage firm located at 5963 West Madison Street, Chicago, Illinois. Our phone number is 773-626-0883. We make the insurance experience easier by shopping for you, saving you time and money. Our agency features the best insurance products, giving you the most competitive prices. We insure needs for less, featuring life, health, annuities, homeowners, auto, SR22, bond cards, business owners policies, general contractors liability, and vacant buildings. Now, we also offer coverages most major insurance companies no longer offer. Please call for a free quote at 773-626-0883.
Attention business owners, radio show producers, and internet radio producers. It's time to crank it up for 2012 with quality radio production. Are you a record label needing hot album promos or EPKs for your new artist? Introducing CoolVoiceRadio.com. Does your internet show need a new intro or outro? How about a promo for your upcoming event? Are you a DJ needing a hot voice for your next hot mixtape? Imagine increased sales in your business from an internet radio spot. We've got you covered with broadcast quality radio spot production with the nation's top voiceover talent, featuring talent like John Heath, Kate Clifford, Bill Thomas, and much, much more. Visit us online at www.coolvoiceradio.com. CoolVoiceRadio.com or call 646-326-7800. Remember, nothing beats the right sound.
Nothing beats the right sound. Well, today is Harold Washington's birthday, and for the next couple of days, the Underground is going to be doing a tribute to Harold Washington all week long. So let's start our tribute to the great Harold Washington.
That was the time when you said Chicago, and someone would respond like a Pavlovian dog, segregation. Or you said Chicago, and people talked about the 1968 riots. Or said Chicago was where everyone went who didn't want to be anybody. But now, anywhere in the world you go, Israel, Egypt, Rome, Shanghai, Tokyo, Nairobi, Zimbabwe. Now, you go to any of those places and you say you're from Chicago, you know what they'll say to you? How's Harold?
Harold won against the odds. He died with an enlarged heart. Not a broken heart. It was enlarged by three. Because he had to have a big heart to make room for all of Chicago.
Ashes to ashes, dust.
We want to do something. We're not going to let this thing die. You know, we're not going to let the dream die.
Martin Luther King had a dream. Harold had a dream.
He was the wave of the future then, and he's the wave of the future now. Because Harold carefully built the leadership in the city that was so democratic, was so fairly put together, that nobody could complain.
He believed that he could achieve a measure of equity or fairness through the political system. He didn't rely on religion or morality. He relied on political power.
I would say that I think he managed to deracialize politics in Chicago when he was elected one-on-one. Where it wasn't just that everybody will always vote for their own clan, and that's just the way it's going to be. You know, after all, it's only been in 4 years ago that Boston elected its first Italian mayor, which was a major breakthrough in Boston. And I think that made a difference. The other, I think, is that he was associated with being successful. Other black mayors before him had been associated with declining cities. They'd gotten control as the cities were on their way out, and he's begun a string of successful black mayors around the country, with Mike White in Cleveland being an example, Kurt Schmoke in Baltimore, a number of black mayors who are now viewed as successful mayors, not simply figures who are coming in a declining period of a city.
What Harold did now has been enlarged and held in people's memory. I mean, Harold is a legend now.
Harold Washington was not the first black mayor of a major northern city. Those honors went to others like Carl Stokes of Cleveland, Coleman Young of Detroit. But those cities were largely abandoned by white flight. Chicago was different. The population in 1983 was equally divided in three: black, white, and Hispanic. It was one of the richest cities on earth. No one suspected that a black political wizard from the South Side had his eye on that prize since he was a boy.
There have been 41 mayors before me. When I was growing up in this city and attending its public schools, it never dawned upon me, nor did I dream, that the flame would pass my way.
Harold used to refer to us as being two households but one family. There's the Washington brood and the Price brood. When Mom married his father, Roy, and her name was Bertha Jones, comes from Southern Illinois. And from that union, there were three boys and a girl. He was athletic, extremely good looking, okay. You know, he had no problem with the ladies at all.
He was brilliant. A cafeteria reader. A man that I can remember when we were, I was maybe 12, he was about 10, and we were playing sandlot baseball, and I never saw him without a book.
He always seemed to have had something a little special above everyone else. Softball, he was the genius. Marbles, he was the genius. I don't care where you went, he just seemed to have been on a plateau just a little above the norm. And of course, we all admired him because I think he placed first in the city and then went downstate. And as I vaguely remember, I think he placed third downstate without practice, without practice.
My father was a Methodist minister and the son of a Methodist minister, but he was also a lawyer and a politician, a very peculiar, strange combination, which breeds a kind of an individual in which there's a high moral tone in the family, a certain discipline, a certain, if you believe it, prove it attitude, certain desire for excellence and a demand for excellence in terms of how you comported your life.
We were out of high school before we learned that his father was a lawyer and his stepmother was a social worker, which of course was big time for the 30s, you see. But he was just one of the rag muffins of the street, an urchin of the street. He never played above that. Whereas he was definitely, as he said, close to the manor born, middle class, upper middle class.
My wife was associate professor of psychology, teaching at Roosevelt University. In her class was Harold Washington. And although she doesn't remember all her students, she remembers him as being outstanding. She says that he showed signs of leadership. And one day, there was a sign in the room that there was an election for the student government. And she said to him, because she recognized his leadership qualities, that you ought to run for that. And he did, and he was elected president of the student government.
He had a great sense of humor, a great sense of humor. I can remember he was at my house one night, and we had had dinner. And my den was at the other end of the house. And when I got through doing the dishes, and I was going up to the den to look at TV, because he was supposed to be up there looking at TV, I get to the entrance hall, and all of a sudden he jumps out of the closet to scare me. Well, he scared me so much until I hollered, and it scared him. So we both wound up in, but he thought that was hilarious.
And the class behind me was Harold Washington. And when I graduated, of course, I was the only black graduating, and in the year behind me after I graduated was Harold Washington, the only black in this class.
He was a classmate of mine in law school. We were both members of a, I suppose I have to acknowledge it, of the class of June 1952 at Northwestern University School of Law. And as a matter of fact, he was the treasurer of the what we then called the Junior Bar Association, the Student Bar Association, during, I guess that would have been our last year in law school. So I go back for many, many, many years. And we always had, by the way, a kind of a marvelous way of explaining all of this. I don't know whether Harold started it or I started it, but we said if you look at the June 1952 graduating class from Northwestern Law School, there are only two faces that stand out, his and mine.
It's difficult for me to sit and describe to you what it was like in 1948 and 49, 50, 51 in law school. For example, when the law firms and the judiciary would come out and interview for positions, they didn't interview us. We were not even on the board to be considered. Writing for the law review, we weren't considered. Things have changed since then, but those are the turbulent experiences that we had. We came out of law school. We didn't have the benefit of going to clerk for this judge or that justice or going to the law office. In fact, we came out of law school.
Yeah, I'm going to hold it right there. I'm going to play a little bit more. You 314, call a 314-381. I think that's my cat, Pianki. I don't know, but I want you to hold on for 1 second. I'm going to play this part two. I'm going to come grab you in a minute. It's my tribute to the great Harold Washington. And I got my mother in here also, so I'm trying to play a little points of order. 347-838-9825. Thank you for listening.
Benefit of going to clerk for this judge or that justice or going to the law office. In fact, when we came out of law school, LaSalle Street wouldn't even rent blacks office space. And we remembered those things. And we were happy that the good Lord in his infinite wisdom saw fit to put us in a position to do something about those evils in our society. And Harold addressed them and did the best he could to eradicate them.
What I did was deliberately, calculatedly, chose an area, a vehicle that I thought I could do some good. That vehicle was the Democratic Party, I thought, for several reasons. One, my people were in the Democratic Party. I didn't put them there. They went there because they felt the same way I felt. But here represents a vehicle through which we can do some social advancement and better our life. Same reason other people make decisions. Not in terms of the best, but in terms of what is available and based on their judgment, which appears to them to be the best. So I entered it. But I have always maintained this feeling about that party. I am not loyal to a structure. I am loyal to people, and I am loyal to an organization to the extent that it is fair to people.
He started moving up the elective ladder by state rep, state senator. He had an independent streak, but... no way was he part of the original reform movement in Chicago, as small and as insignificant as that was.
I was a corporation counsel for 4 years in the city of Chicago. I was a secretary to Congressman Metcalf when he was alderman. I worked in the Metropolitan Sanitary District as a junior attorney. I spent my whole life in city government and city politics.
I was Washington's campaign manager when he ran for state representative in the 60s. And we had a big party for him. and invited Mayor Daley out, who in those days didn't come out on Sundays. I think this party was on a weekend. And he came out to wish Harold Washington well.
He was not a guy who ran in PAC's social groups. And he had he would disappear at times. And our relationship was kind of amazing because in the office sometimes we were there 8, 9 o'clock at night. And sometimes on the weekend, on Friday nights, especially all night long, maybe I shouldn't. we had a friendly poker game, and we would sometimes be there all night.
And Washington was single at the time. He had been married. Well, he was married, but he was living single. And he knew a lot of people, and we went to a lot of parties in those days. And eventually I fell into the marriage fold, and that somewhat stopped, but we always worked politically together.
When I first met Hal, Hal was not the role model he was in the 80s. In the latter 60s, early 70s, Hal had some serious problems. He had a major accident, almost cost him his life, almost cost him the lives of others. He decided in 1970, 69, never to drive again. So we became fast friends because I drove for him from 69 to 82.
He failed to file taxes for approximately 5 years. He was not evading taxes. He just didn't file.
But he was not a man who did not pay taxes. Harold's income was the legislature.
In any event, he let 5 years of taxes go, where the whole net difference was, I think, $500, between $500 and $1,000. And when they called him in on this, he could have avoided jail. He could have avoided serious conflict. All he had to do was appear once or twice, plead forgetfulness, exhibit some remorse. But the kind of stubbornness that was Harold, that was his blessing and his flaw, went to work there, and out of stubbornness, Harold virtually caused the judge to put him in jail.
I don't walk down the street with a sign on my back saying I didn't file income tax returns for certain years, nor do I slip through the night from shadow to shadow like a thief because of it. I paid the penalty for it. Judge Perry, when he sentenced me, said this to me, and I'll never forget it. And I think it bears here because it's not a special plea. It comes from a dispassionate person, one who heard all the facts. And he said to me, he said, I know your record, the same record you've read. You are a man who have dedicated yourself to public service. And from what I see, what has happened here is that you work so hard and assiduously at your chosen field that you have failed to and been neglected in your own personal affairs. He says, it's tragic. He says, it's something you can rectify.
If he had shortcomings, I think he recognized those shortcomings in himself. And during those years that some people call the wild years, Harold didn't really want to step out front. But after, I think, he got better control of his life and had started focusing on a direction that he wanted to go to accomplish things himself, not just for himself, but for others, then he changed.
He represented the coming together of two strains in the development of African-American politics in this country. You traditionally had the civil rights activists who stayed away from elective office, who didn't really participate. They were activists, they were community leaders, they were very often preachers. They stayed outside of the elective realm. Then you had those who more often than not had nothing to do with the civil rights agenda, who were there to parlay favors and play the patronage games and be part of the machine. These two tracks had been parallel over time. Harold broke that parallel and brought those two tracks together.
When he became state representative, that was an electrifying event. But by the time he became a senator, and he began to play a major role in our lives.
Through most of his career in the legislature, he went along with the traditional machine issues. He was very consistent, though, on the civil rights issues and the black-related issues.
Washington earned a record as a smart, often inspired legislator. After the death of Mayor Richard J. Daley in 1976, he ran for mayor, coming in third in a four-person race and winning only five black wards. In 1980, he ran for Congress and won.
He was not a man who took on a lot of quixotic campaigns. And I think he ran in 77 understanding he was going to lose by, you know, some substantial amount, you know, barring a miracle. But understood that in historically at that time, the way blacks got to be mayors of big cities was to run and lose and then run again.
That experience became an underlying factor for the later run.
Besides a consummate campaigner, he was also a consummate legislator. He really loved the legislative process. He was in Congress. He'd gone there, had made an impact right away. The kind of tradition at the time was congressmen usually only got two assignments to committees. Because of his experience in the General Assembly, they gave him three. And the other thing that was happening was the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act. They gave Harrell the charge of being the leader and getting and building support for the Voting Rights Act around the country.
He knew the subject matter, and he was able to really be persuasive on the floor. If anybody reads the congressional record, he was a master. I mean, he studied it like a constitutional expert.
He left the Congress in the first few months and began to campaign. He said at that time, he was thanking his constituency for having elected the congressman. But when in fact, what we were doing was organizing for the mayoralty. He started, as you'll be proud to know, by going to laundromats. We did laundromats on Cottage, on King, on State. And Halston had all his mornings going to laundromats thanking females, when in fact we're in fact launching the mayoralty.
Back home in Chicago, Mayor Jane Byrne had lost the loyalty of African-American voters. Political activist Lou Palmer was promising, "We shall see in 83. At the grassroots, the conditions were ripe for Harold Washington to lead a crusade.
Jane Byrne, from the moment she was elected mayor of the city of Chicago in 1979 in an upset, she assumed that someday Richard M. Daley was going to try to take her job from her. And she was obsessed with that. She was focused on Richard M. Daley as the only candidate that was ever going to wrest the mantle from her. And so she did things like kicking African Americans off the school board and putting on representatives of the Northwest and Southwest sides in Chicago, not known for their racial tolerance, to replace blacks that have been kicked off the school board. She did the same thing at the Chicago Housing Authority, which was almost 99% black. So she seemed to be going out of her way, frankly, to wave a red flag in front of the black community, because it was her belief that she would rally all the white voters and that Rich Daley, you know, would be trying to get some black votes, and that he wouldn't be very credible in trying to get black votes.
Well, when Harold, out of courtesy, appeared at one of these plebiscites at Bethlehem, his whole persona, his whole gift, his charisma, just overwhelmed people, and it was decided that we had to persuade him to run, because it was obvious that he was the most popular and the most likely candidate to be able to run a good race.
Few of us said, well, maybe this might be another opportunity, since Jane Byrne is not the same as the machine. Daley, the old man, is gone. Blandick's been destroyed. This may be an opportunity again for a black to run.
He was the man that was sent here from somewhere, from some planet, somehow, and as we reviewed his life, we knew that he was the man to represent us.
Harold's feeling was, it may be,
but there are too many holes. No money, no way to mobilize the people, to get them to come out and vote, and you need a massive street organization and street effort to do it.
And he also wanted to make sure that Daley and Byrne were going to go at each other. To say they didn't like each other would be an understatement. He saw the possibility, as I said at the time, of being the cream in a reverse Oreo cookie.
I have decided to be a candidate for mayor of Chicago.
I'm announcing my candidacy today for a second term as mayor.
I cannot watch the city of Chicago destroyed by petty politics and bad government. I have been urged by the earnest pleas of thousands of people to enter this race. Therefore, I hereby declare my candidacy for mayor.
As prosecutor, drug convictions rose by 25%. And as mayor, even more can be done to make our neighborhoods safe again.
So what's to keep us from making this candidate our next mayor? Nothing. Elect the one candidate qualified to be the mayor, Harold Washington.
We can all win.
Well, the public television station in Chicago, WTTW, felt very strongly that they should take the lead in organizing mayoral debates in 1983, and I was selected to be the producer and the chief negotiator representing WTTW in the three warring factions. When Harold Washington starred in that first debate and literally just lowered the boom on Jane Byrne in his opening statement, that was the defining moment. And just as John Kennedy used his first presidential debate to sort of define and make him respectable to people who maybe just viewed him as a lightweight United States senator, I think what happened in that very first debate is that a lot of middle-class blacks in Chicago, who perhaps had not really given Harold Washington an opportunity or a chance, they saw in that first debate that this was an African-American who was standing up there toe-to-toe with the son of the former mayor and the current mayor, and he whipped their butt that night.
There was this instant flash pride that just whipped through the black community, and you saw it as people walked down the street. I mean, they wore these buttons like badges of courage or something.
And from the point of that debate on, being responsible for the precinct coordinator, I could not keep up with the volunteers. It was almost like trying to herd cats.
It was a crusade that took on almost religious or gospel character. It was a duty. It became a sort of a civic religion, if you will.
Harold, he didn't change his pitch much. I would make the rounds with him whenever I could as we went to the wards and to the Puerto Rican community and the gay community and the labor community and the churches. I can't emphasize the churches too much.
I believe in the powers of redemption, and I simply cannot believe in the God I worship that he would permit us to sit on this earth for 400 years, or rather in this country for 400 years, and suffer the indignities which we have suffered, piled time after time, high after high, and so heavy it has almost broken the backs of one of the most powerful people in this world.
And the people of Chicago united with Richard M. Daley to be the next mayor of Chicago.
Everybody.
I had been a close observer of the political scene when I was at the University of Chicago, and I had much more than a passing acquaintance with Richard Daley, the mayor at the time. And although he and I were on quite friendly terms, warm friendly terms, I was under no illusion about the racial politics in the city, and you know, in counting the votes, it just didn't seem to add up that anyone except a person of European descent would be able to seize the post of mayor.
Good evening. This is the CBS Evening News. Dan Rather reporting. The results of Chicago's three-way race for the Democratic nomination for mayor today took many in that city and the nation by surprise. Bob McNamara reports on the Illinois congressman who beat the incumbent, the name, the machine, and the odds and now stands a good chance to become the first black mayor of the nation's second largest city.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next mayor of the city of Chicago, Mayor Harold Washington, we want that.
You want Harold?
No!
You really got it now.
Black in the newsroom were delighted. The whites looked as if their mother had died. I mean, there was this great, in the Tribune, there was this great funk that just hung in the air. You could feel it. You could almost slice it with a butter knife. In the meantime, the few blacks that worked there, we walked around and we were so elated, but because of the general sour faces, we were afraid to show it. So we walked around professional, and we would go into a private room somewhere, someone's office, shut the door, and they go, yeah!
On that night when Washington won, and the night he claimed victory at the old McCormick Inn, and Jesse Jackson came to the podium, it was an absolute red flag to many white voters in Chicago. Even someone like Bernie Epton, who really gets unmentioned in these stories, who was all set to run as a Hyde Park white liberal against Jane Byrne, did a 180 and became the right-wing candidate of, before it's too late.
I have listened patiently to that clown in the radio and television, and I'm speaking to both clowns now, and I've had just about enough. If any one of you did what my distinguished congressman did, you'd still be serving time.
I tried to talk my brother out of it because I know my brother. He liked Harold Washington, and he didn't think he could be elected, but he was a gambler.
Epton, a distinguished legislator, lawyer, and businessman. Washington, found guilty of unlawfully converting clients' money to his own use and barred from practicing law for 5.5 years. Epton, honored repeatedly for service to his country and his community. Washington, convicted and jailed for repeated criminal tax law violations. The U.S. attorney said he didn't even file his returns for 19 consecutive years. Which one do you think should be Chicago's next mayor?
But in the meantime, you have racist white policemen feeding all sorts of garbage and handing out all sorts of racist literature, accusing Harold Washington of being all sorts of things, from a child molester to homosexual, things with big lips and bones through the nose and watermelons and spitting watermelon seeds. I mean, just very, very gloves off racist literature.
There was a real desperation on the part of some to stop his election, and that's what. There was a real desperation on the part of some to stop his election, and that's what made the 1983 election the most vituperative and emotional election that I've ever seen.
Harold was supposed to speak at St. Pascal's Church, and there was this reaction from the white community, and there was this angry mob of white people. And as we're going in, someone had spray painted on the church, "Die, nigger, die," on the church. And it occurred to me that I was not in friendly territory.
Palm Sunday, 1983. Washington and former Vice President Walter Mondale tried to attend Mass at St. Pascal's Church on the city's northwest side. They were met by a booing crowd of Epton supporters and Right to Life demonstrators. Epton apologized, but the incident made national news.
Certainly, when you go to church, you're certain you should be allowed to worship without the intrusion like that. And if there were supporters of mine, I apologize.
Oh, it was ugly. Epton played right
directly into the hands of the people who were really a very small segment of the Chicago population, but a very vocal segment. And what was such a cry about this is that Epton was known to many of us around Harold. And throughout the entire campaign, he was calling every night in back channels offering personal apologies.
I voted for Jane Byrne in the primary, and I think she had her chance. She lost. And now it's time for Bernard Epton.
I want to thank Mr. Epton because he's a man of integrity. Mr. Washington is a convicted criminal.
Hey, if he can't pay his taxes and he can't produce a service when he's a lawyer and he goes to jail, and how can you honestly ask a man like this to be a mayor?
I'm a Democrat, and I voted for Daley in the primary, and I'm going with Bernie Epton all the way.
That hurt Bernie terribly. Bernie was not a bigot. The press made him a bigot.
Bill Zimmerman was our media consultant, and he wanted to do an ad that really exposed the racism that was going on. And the strategy committee was divided. Some wanted to do it. Others thought that we would play into and offend some of our, you know, liberal supporters if we responded to these issues of racism.
It was so controversial inside of the campaign that it was one of the few instances where we really asked Harold himself to come off the campaign trail and screen it. So he came in and he took a look at the spot and he said, no, it should not run.
There are moments in our country's history of which all Americans are thoroughly and profoundly ashamed. One of those moments may be happening now, here in Chicago. When you vote on Tuesday, be sure it's a vote you can be proud of.
Lo and behold, I was just gotten home, laid back, and watched the news, kicked back in my bed. All of a sudden, the spot comes on television. I almost had a heart attack. I said, what in the world is going on? 2 minutes later, my phone's ringing. It's the candidate. How did that piece get on? I thought I killed that. Everybody's out here just stopping me in the street talking about that. We had a major storm on our hands.
And so after one day, we pulled it. And that was because, you know, we had, you know, this kind of turmoil.
We were behind, or neck and neck, I forget which, but the election was not in the bag. We had to dynamite these households in the lakefront. So we went for the grand bag strategy, and we were able to be successful. On that Sunday, we got the New York Times story, a cover story, in which Harold was featured. 11 o'clock that day, he was featured on Meet the Press. Luckily, Bernie Epton, his opponent, did not show up. So Harold had a complete run on national television for 30 minutes. Which was wonderful. Then at 6, he was a lead piece on 60 Minutes.
Epton thought he could win with white votes alone. Washington added white liberals, Hispanics, and other minorities to his coalition. Everyone in Chicago chose sides.
I will initiate your reforms, but I charge each and every one of you to rededicate your efforts to heal the divisions that have plagued us. Each of us must reach out in open arms. Together we will overcome our problems and restore Chicago to its proper position as one of the most dynamic cities in all the world. The whole nation is watching as Chicago has sent a powerful message. History. History was made tonight.
Washington won by 46,000 votes out of the 1.3 million votes cast. Three-quarters of Chicago voters came to the polls that day. An extraordinary 98% of African Americans voted for Washington. The inauguration ceremony at Navy Pier was the hottest ticket in town. There was a sense of history as Washington came to the stage. The 42nd mayor was sworn into office by his former law partner, Justice Charles Freeman.
of the office of mayor of the city of Chicago.
That I will faithfully discharge the duties of the office of mayor of the city of Chicago.
According to the best of my ability.
According to the best of my ability.
Congratulations.
Okay. The first thing you told me is to do no harm. You told me that the guiding principle of government is to do the greatest good. And your instructions, which I heard from neighborhood after neighborhood, said to be patient, be fair, be candid, in short, to continue to tell the truth. Business as usual will not be accepted by any part of this city. Business as usual will not be accepted by this chief executive of this city.
He threw down the gauntlet at that inauguration, indicating that business as usual would not continue. He, though she was on the platform, he openly castigated Jane Byrne. I was sitting in the front row and I saw her turn red, shocked, because he was there. It was not diplomatic at all. He was very open with what he intended to do. They immediately began to line up their forces. They were, of course, geared by racism and greed and insecurity, because it was clear to them, at least, that they were not going to be able to control this man as they had Jane Byrne.
Well, it was open warfare. He came in and with a what he believed to be a mandate to change government, and he didn't have the votes.
Chicago has a strong council, weak mayor system. Washington's opponents had a 29-21 majority. To buy time, the new mayor dismissed the first council meeting.
The president recognizes Alderman Terrace.
I move we adjourn.
You heard the motion. All the favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, no. The council is adjourned.
But led by Alderman Edward Podolak, the 29 took control and ignited a political firestorm called Council Wars.
We are looking at neighborhood against neighborhood. We are looking against race against race. We are making a decision that will make it impossible for the mayor of the city of Chicago to deal with the problems of the city, because he will be fighting you, the members of the city council.
We want Harold here too, but he ran away.
Council Wars was fighting a race war and a political war by day, and trying to run a government starting at 5:30 in the evening. We were in the trenches. Every day for a year and a half, you'd come in there, and it was take no prisoners. Who could wreak the most harm to the... Who could outreact the other? I mean, it was tough, two-fisted chess.
Well done, Mayor, but I counter with this negotiated majority. Then take this grassroots support. I maintain my majority. Then I file a suit in court. But the decision is in my favor. You may have prevailed at this juncture, Podolak, but I will assiduously pursue your disestablishment. Perhaps, Mayor, but to do so, you must use the dark side of the clout. You must make deals and compromises. Never!
Harold was as tough and as hard-nosed a politician as you're ever going to find. He was cold. And that is not to denigrate him in any fashion. If you're going to survive in the business of politics, it's, as Harold used to say, politics ain't beanbags. And that's absolutely true. You're either going to play the game to its fullest, or you're going to die in the game.
Talent in the wrong head. A vicious, angry man. Therein lies the rub. An absolute head, toe, unmitigated, full fleshy hustler.
Some of the things that I did in those days, if I had the ability to change them, I probably would. But that's not life. You can't go back and change.
I'm saying aye. Opposed. Meeting's adjourned.
But it was rough, though. A lot of people were hurt. We had to do things that were... I remember we had to threaten to shut down our airport. We actually put in a doomsday shutdown plan. I mean, we took the city on one hell of a white-knuckle ride for a year and a half. I mean, we scared America. I mean, it was a take no prisoners kind of a war, but we had to, because we were up against some adversaries who did not give us any quarter, and we had to win, and we did win.
And Alderman Vodoliak, who was the leader of the 29, rose, and the mayor glared at him and said, "For what purpose does the alderman of the 10th ward arise?" And he says, "Mr. President, I just want to thank you." He says, "Thank me for what?" "Well, a horse ran an aqueduct named Harold, and he won. So I just wanted to thank you for the tip." And everybody laughed, of course. And after the laughter subsided, Harold said, "If you were a gentleman, you would share your winnings." And, of course, everybody laughed. And after they finally stopped laughing, Vodoliak said, "That's all I've been trying to tell you for 3 years."
We inherited a city which was not bankrupt, but in tremendous fiscal strain, long-standing fiscal stress, the rate maker said. We cleaned it up in 3 years, balanced the budget, laid off 8,000 people, got a good cash flow, changed the accounting system, and wound up with an increased bond rating, first time in 30 years the city had it.
People in Washington were asking me about balancing the federal budget, and they said, "Isn't that hard?" And I said, "That's nothing compared to balancing the Chicago city budget." I said, "Members of Congress don't wear guns in the chamber, and... in the city council, there were a lot of guns there that weren't being worn by active police officers."
1986 began with bad news. An FBI sting called Operation Incubator had snared several Washington officials and aldermen in a bribery scandal.
The U.S. attorney, who at that time was a man named Anton Valukas, who was a Republican, sent in a mole who was a murderer, who had been involved in all kinds of crimes, who had been investigated for murders in Wisconsin and Florida, and in fact was going to be, to my understanding, indicted in Florida until they came and got him, because he said he had some connections that he could go to Chicago and get Harold Washington.
They sent him into Chicago to try and, in effect, entrap some people on the mayor's staff. And in fact, they entrapped some aldermen. He spread money among some of the people in the mayor's administration.
And they indicted a number of people, myself included. And they tried to get to Harold. They asked me to get to Harold, quite frankly. And, of course, you know, my response to that was no way.
Harold always was confident that that of his own integrity. He was never in politics for money. He was never in it for contracts. He was never looking for an inside deal for himself, and so that he had a confidence that carried through, that no matter what anyone was attempting to do to him, whether it was bug him or entrap him, that he didn't have anything to fear because he hadn't done anything wrong.
The mayor had to terminate a department head. And I think that there were at least two or three aldermen who were indicted and sent to prison as a result of that. Again, that was a what I thought was a targeting of a very popular African-American mayor by the federal government.
Then, suddenly it seemed all the winds were in Harold Washington's column. Citing the Voting Rights Act that Washington had passed when he was in Congress, federal judges redistricted Chicago's wards. Minority voters got more aldermen, and the mayor won control of the city council. The mayor's reforms were finally voted on, and power was now firmly in the hands of Harold Washington.
Harold Washington was a reform mayor, and people forget that. The first reform mayor in in our modern history. Reform meant a lot of things, and I think what people want to do, particularly those who hated him, that now say nice things about him, is they want to leave the legacy of Harold Washington around personality, that he was bright, which he was, that he was articulate, that he was funny, that he was all these things, and he was all that and more. But the primary reason that Harold Washington was able to put together that coalition, and the primary reason that people all over the world still respect him, is that he had an agenda.
The mayor was absolutely committed to both racial and gender equality.
He had given more positions in City Hall to women, Latinos, more blacks than had ever been case. I mean, positions of power.
No one, but no one in this city, no matter where they live or how they live, is free from the fairness of our administration. We'll find you and be fair to you wherever you are.
But Jane Byrne and Edward Doleac were still on the scene.
Jane Byrne had returned. Jane had a tremendous capacity for reinventing herself, and she had done a nice job of that in the months leading up to the mayoral primary. And so going into that race, it was really a serious race, the primary.
As current mayor and the previous mayor escalate their views of the past 8 years, the three other candidates seem to be left in the wind. That is Mr. Pedroliak, Mr. Hines, and myself.
How are you?
I remember sitting in Harold's office the day after the primary, and we were all exultant. And then Harold got somewhat melancholy, and he said, you know, here we are. I got 20% of the white vote, and we're happy about that because that was a breakthrough for us. He said, well, you know, I think I earned more than 20% of that vote. And he kind of paused. He said, ain't it a bitch to be a black man in the land of the free and the home of the brave?
But once that was over, most of the aldermen who had been part of the 29, who won re-election in 87, basically gave up. And Washington had a solid majority of 35 or 40 aldermen.
When people like me and others say, you know, Mr. Mayor, maybe you don't realize it, man, but you just gained about 25 pounds, you know. You take care of my security. You know, I'm taking care of me. Over a period of time, when you can defy your doctors and don't make your doctor appointments, when you don't buy your suits off the rack anymore, you know, people are making them for you. When you don't realize that eating late at night and then holding an hour conversation with somebody about some personal problem that further drains you from a full day's activity and then go to bed, that has a toll. It takes a toll over a period.
Before Thanksgiving 1987, the former athlete weighed 284 pounds and could hardly lift the shovel at a ceremonial groundbreaking.
One.
Oh, two.
Two.
We
three.
Know what to do.
There we go.
Now on three.
Minutes later, a massive heart attack.
Can't say anything about his condition. The doctors are with him now, except to say that at just slightly after 11 o'clock this morning, he slumped at his desk.
Is the mayor still alive?
To the best of my knowledge, yes.
What is his condition at this time?
The doctors are working on him now.
He is still alive, though?
Yes. I was working in the book, and I heard a thump, a loud thump, as if he had hit his hand on the desk. And I looked up, and it was his cheek that was on the desk. His right cheek was on the desk, and I thought, well, he's reaching under his desk to pick up something. You know, and that was the first half a second. And the second half a second, I mean, then it came to me, no, this isn't right, something's drastically wrong. And at that point, he began rasping. He was face down on the desk and rasping.
Unfortunately, the mayor sustained irreversible brain damage. We could not get any signs of neurologic recovery nor spontaneous cardiac activity, and he was pronounced dead at 1:36 this afternoon.
Word has just come that the mayor has passed.
At that moment, there were meetings already of former Harold Washington supporters, former Harold Washington opponents, and a third group of people who had been Harold Washington supporters but who were now looking to broker an even better deal for themselves.
My dear friend, we loved you much, but God loved you more.
I'll see you in the morning, buddy. We will not let you down. We will not let you down. We will not let you down.
On December 1st, I think it was, they called a meeting of the city council to select from among our membership a person who would serve as the acting mayor.
The proceedings were happening with a chanting mob out in front of City Hall. The contest was between whether Tim Evans or Gene Sawyer would become acting mayor. It boiled down to those two because even the mayor's opposition realized that the mayor's successor should be someone from his own majority. And these were two majority leaders, and they had pretty much the consensus following of the rest. But because they, Gene Sawyer and Tim Evans, couldn't between them agree on who should succeed, you had some really ugly politics being played out.
Anytime you get folks in a room that's talking about, yes, we will support you if you get rid of all of the mayor's staff, get rid of all of his programs, something is wrong with that.
Sawyer is elected acting mayor.
In a bitter struggle for succession, Washington's closest allies lost. The city council named Alderman Eugene Sawyer as interim mayor, and Sawyer, like Richard Daley after him, kept Washington's reforms.
Harold was there ahead of his time, and the proof of that is what happened after he passed away. Nobody could put it back together again. Without Harold, that's the final political epitaph of the highest commendation you can give anybody. And this is tragic, of course, but it fell apart after Harold.
It was tough. It was ugly sometimes. It exposed some of the underbellies and bad characteristics of Chicago and of America. But in the end, I think the price was well worth it. Because we got a city that is a much better place to live. It's more mature. We've gotten past a lot of the problems that made us a less strong and a less beautiful city than we are now. I think Chicago grew 50 years from those 55 months in Harold and City Hall, at least a half a century. That's why people love him so now, because they understood what he gave to the city. What he gave was his life.
Harold Washington won the political wars and used his power to renew the neighborhoods. After he showed the way, Jesse Jackson ran for president. His son, Jesse Jr., became a Chicago congressman. His ally, Carol Moseley Braun, became the first black female U.S. senator. Without fanfare, blacks and Hispanics today hold office nationwide. The great Harold Washington Library is a testimony to a mayor who liked to read as much as he liked to fight. One of the most beloved leaders of our time.
We need more love in this world in order to survive.
Yeah, I was trying to play the entire broadcast, but I thought it was prevalent just to play the whole show. I'm sorry I didn't get with you. I'm going to be doing the whole week of Harold Washington. No man with something. Like you said, Jesse ran for president, Jesse Jr., disgraced congressman ran for his congressman seat, Carol Mosley Braun, first black woman senator, and then Barack Obama, the first black president. I mean, hair had an effect on everybody. And so I'm glad you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm sorry, Pianchi, I didn't get on there and you. I should have been in the chat room chatting with you, but I apologize for that. Okay, everybody, my name is Jimmy Lee. This is Jimmy Lee's Underground Radio, and we're going to be on tomorrow with some more for breaking news, information about the tragedy that ensued in Boston. We're going to have some updates on that, and we're going to also be finishing our tribute to Harold Washington. Again, everybody, thank you for listening. Good night, and may your God be with you. To all those citizens in Boston, our prayers with you also. See you tomorrow, everybody.
Our heroes proved in liberating strife, who more than self their country loved.
Does it better, because I got a message that says he does it better. Thank you for listening. See y'all tomorrow. Good night. You done, Ebony? You saved it? May your God be with you always.